Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me very great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening to the 1994 Founders Day Lecture, which is to be given this year by a very old friend of the school, indeed, very old, if I almost say family friend of the school, since your mother, I think, was a lecturer here, Frank, the Right Honourable Lord Judd. Frank Judd was at the school when he wasn't with his mother as a student in 1953 to 1956. He then went into the Royal Air Force to do his national service, and as was, I think, the custom for some national servicemen, got out early to fight a general election as the youngest Labour contestant. He served for many years as the Labour MP for Portsmouth West and then Portsmouth North, and appropriately enough, amongst many other positions in the government, served as a Minister of State for the Navy. But his first love, right from graduation from the LSE, was with international affairs. And it is, of course, that leads him here tonight, and it's that with which he is predominantly associated. It started with his being Secretary General of the International Voluntary Service in 1960, continued with his being Minister of State for Overseas Development in the 70s, culminated in one sense as Director of Oxfam in the 80s, and since that time, he has been a powerful, articulate, and persuasive spokesman on behalf of development and the wider global concerns. More recently, he's just returned from Geneva, where as the British member, he's been attending the final drafting session of the Commission on Global Governments. This commission was the brainchild of Willy Brandt, set up shortly before his death. It is jointly chaired by Ingvar Carlsson, the new Prime Minister of Sweden, and Sunny Ramphal. Its report will be published by OUP in late January as a contribution to the deliberations surrounding the 50th anniversary of the United Nations. And I suspect some of it, at least, will be foreshadowed in the lecture which I'd now like to invite him to give on ideology, values, and governments and governance, the global challenges. Frank.
Well, thank you, John, for that very generous introduction. I'd love to give a preview of the Global Commission report, but at this stage, I'm sure you'll understand that that just would not be in order. I have approached this task today, indeed, with some trepidation. As will become abundantly clear in the hour for which I've been asked to speak, I am not an academic. I did have three very lively and enjoyable years at the school as an undergraduate, but they were marked by absolutely no indication of any academic or scholastic inclination whatsoever. What, therefore, I say today in this centre of excellence, of which I'm proud to be a governor, is learning what I've learnt from life. Rather than the academic sources, which it's customary to acknowledge for papers or lectures of this sort, I must warmly thank those people with whom I've lived and worked and from whom I'm still learning every day of my life. Family, friends, colleagues, and the numerous people with whom I've been privileged to mix across the world. The concept of human rights is rooted in justice. In 1948, following the horror and suffering brought about by two world wars, the political leaders of the world, acting through the United Nations, drew up and declared their support for a universal declaration of human rights. It begins uncompromisingly. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. In the succeeding 30 articles, it goes on to spell out those rights which form the basis of human dignity. First, the political rights. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person, the right to freedom of movement, the right to a nationality, equality before the law, the right to freedom of thought, opinion, peaceful assembly and association, freedom from arbitrary arrest, slavery or servitude, torture or cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment. Then come the social and economic rights, the right to education, the right to marry, to own property, the right freely to participate in the cultural life of the community, the right to work, to have equal pay for equal work, and a standard of living adequate for health and well-being, the right to form and join trade unions, the right to rest and leisure. Whilst with hindsight, we can see that this declaration might well have been balanced by a declaration of human responsibilities, in those immediate post-war years, there was a great deal of conviction about what an emancipating civilized society should be. And I believe it's just possible that at least some of those who now lament the absence of an emphasis on responsibilities do so from a far less imaginative position. The fulfillment of those 1948 ideals is too often conspicuous by its absence. Even in the European community, there are today more than 2.5 million homeless, too many within a stone's throw of the school itself. But the ideals do powerfully set out a vision of what was then firmly believed could and should be the goal of all nations. The preamble leaves no doubt why this was thought to be such an urgent and important objective. Recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. And disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts. In the shadow of Bosnia, Iraq, Rwanda, and the rest, these words speak as a powerful rebuke from history. Here in the UK itself, with 8 people murdered in racist attacks in 1993, with the number of incidents involving racist attacks, racial violence, and racial harassment increasing from some 4,400 in 1988 to some 7,800 in 1992, with too many neighborhoods in our major cities where ethnic minorities live in fear, we ourselves present a disturbing prospect. Justice, of course, has many shades of meaning, from the legal system itself to the philosophical concept of fairness which should underlie it. The Emperor Justinian in the 6th century gave as good a definition as any I've come across. Justice is the consistent and perpetual wish to render everyone his due. The reality of the world, however, falls sadly short of this ideal. There is, as the Commission on Social Justice has aptly put it, a justice gap. In England, a 19th century judge once remarked, justice is open to all, like the Ritz Hotel. And all too often, the injustice encapsulated by the writer Anatole France prevails. To disarm the strong and arm the weak would be to change the social order. Justice is the means by which established injustices are sanctioned. Most, perhaps not quite all of us here this evening, are lucky enough to enjoy the full range of the human rights set out in the aspirations of the post-war United Nations. We have enough to eat, shelter, access to healthcare, education. We can meet in public and speak our minds freely without undue fear of political violence against us or our families. But we're the lucky few. There are still millions in the world for whom such rights are no more than a dream. During the years that I've spent working in both Houses of Parliament and with exciting frontline organisations like Voluntary Service Overseas and Oxfam, I have frequently seen at first hand the evidence of human rights denied by war, by government oppression, by prejudice, by ignorance, by extreme poverty, or by international indifference. I'll never forget a visit I made to war-torn Mozambique. I vividly recall talking with some of the thousands of displaced people who'd lost literally everything, even family, sometimes chopped to death before their eyes. I was moved by their courage and resilience as they asked for tools and seed to start growing their own food again. But I asked myself what sort of charlatan I would be to return home to Britain as director of Oxfam, simply calling for more assistance while joining a conspiracy of silence about the causes. Humanitarian commitment, surely above all, demanded the question, why? Why has this happened? How can human catastrophes like this be prevented? In other words, the motto of the school was never more relevant. Rerum cognoscere causas. All over the world, Oxfam and other organizations like it support people who are on the front line in the fight against poverty and oppression. These people may be grateful for the charity which helps to keep them alive, but theirs is primarily a struggle for justice. Development cannot be handed out. It must be predicated on people's freedom to exercise political, civil, economic, and social rights. How can landless families feed their children when they have no way of earning a living? Or how can South American plantation laborers break out of their cycle of poverty when the local landowner orders the assassination of their leader with impunity? Or how can street children begin to have a future when their choice is to live like rats in sewers or be shot to keep some city tidy? Fighting poverty involves fighting hunger, homelessness, disease, ignorance, and famine, but it also involves backing poor people in their fight against marginalization, oppression, violence, voicelessness, fear, and most important of all, political and economic injustice. Indeed, how many of us in British politics today speak with and for our own casualties of the market as distinct from talking about them? I can remember on a visit towards the end of my time in Oxfam to Colombia and Central America, that visit culminating with a conversation which it was a great privilege to have with the courageous bishop of San Cristobal, about whom you may have heard a good deal recently in the context of what's been happening in Chiapas. Talking with that bishop about my experiences in Colombia, where I'd seen the poor marginalized, brave young people, often students giving up their studies to risk torture, assassination, to work with the marginalized poor, where in Salvador I'd managed to get into the capital in a lull of the fighting to talk with people who were dealing and managing to hold life together after years of conflict in that country. I'd gone on from there to Guatemala, and in one village in Guatemala I'd visited, the paramilitaries had arrived previously, had ordered the villagers outside their homes, had taken named individuals, shot them down in cold blood, and compelled the villagers to dig communal graves in which they were buried. I'd moved from there on to South Mexico, where I'd seen the harassment of the Guatemalan refugees, and I had seen the struggle of the Mexican Indians, and we're talking with the bishop about this. And at the end of our conversation, I said to the bishop, but have you got a message for us in Oxfam? He looked me very sternly in the eye. He was very fluent in English. He said, yes, there are three things I'd like to say to you. He said, first, these things we've been talking about and discussing. In these situations, you can't be neutral. You can't sanitize your assistance. He said, in these situations, you have to stand up and be counted. And then he said, I've read the Oxfam literature. You use the language of equality. But he said, how far is the reality, how great is the reality of this equality? Or how far are these people the indispensable objects for your institutional needs? And then he said, looking at me particularly sternly, he said, and solidarity. And he said, what is solidarity? And he said, solidarity is the process of identification at the level of the individual, the family, the group, the nation. He said, Frank, remember, solidarity is the modern meaning of charity. And when I thought about it, it was so right. The opportunities I'd been able to have, sitting literally late into the night under the stars with blankets around my shoulder, talking with people in parts of Africa, Asia, wherever. Yes, there might be a well that was needed. Yes, there might be seed that was needed. But so often what we came round to talking about was human dignity and the fact that these people were people with their own integrity, that they mattered as people, and that that, above all, was what they yearned to see recognized. A few stark global statistics may help to underscore the scale of the challenge which confronts us. Somewhere still, statistically, every 2.4 seconds of every day, a small child dies from poverty. 1.3 billion, a fifth of the world's population, live in absolute poverty, a figure expected to rise to over 2 billion by the end of the decade. 1.75 billion people have no access to safe water, and 3 billion are without basic sanitation. The number of refugees has risen from 2.5 million in 1970 to a desperate 18.5 million or more today, and there are between 24 and 30 million internally displaced people without even the theoretical protection of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees because they have not crossed the frontier. Rerum cognoscere causas. What are the causes of this appalling poverty and injustice? Armed conflict? Neglect or abuse of the environment, lack of democratically accountable government, unpayable debt, adverse terms of trade, extravagant consumption of finite resources, and inappropriate aid policies. Injustice is common to them all, whether it's the injustice of the rich world siphoning off in debt servicing the small resources of the poor, the injustice of a corrupt landowner refusing a peasant permission to cultivate a patch of his land, or the injustice created by the international arms trade. Most development organizations would greatly prefer to be primarily involved in development work of the kind that, through partnership, enables the poor to become a little less poor. Sadly, in recent years, too much of their efforts have had to be directed in response to urgent human need and terrible injustices created directly by war. The connection between war and famine is indisputable. It's no coincidence that every major famine in recent years has taken place in a war zone. The extraordinary Eurocentric view of peace since 1945 is cruelly belied by the 150 wars, mainly in the Third World, in which some 30 million people have died. These wars have disrupted and destroyed agricultural production, rural and urban communities, development programs, and entire economies. Human rights are undermined by the plight of refugees or the displaced. In the Second World War, 52% of the war-related deaths worldwide were civilian. Today, it's estimated that the proportion is something like 90%. Bosnia, Angola, Rwanda have grimly spelt it out. When, indeed, will we learn? The arms trade feeds the war monster across the world and has accentuated widespread damaging instability, even where no formal conflict exists. It's a disturbing paradox that the five permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations account for over 85% of the world's conventional arms trade, and that two-thirds of the sales are to the poorest countries of the world. Rwanda is currently proving the latest in a long list of war-related famines that has included Somalia, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Sudan, and Liberia. As well as the direct destruction, war forces people to abandon their land and breaks up families, the basic units of subsistence agriculture. It's sometimes literally true that if only we could stop the fighting, we could end the famine. No country can develop under conditions of war, and the damage and destruction take years to repair. The cost of war and its consequences are staggering. Stopping people dying in Rwanda, Bosnia, or Angola is only the start of a very long road. In Mozambique, for example, they will have to rebuild completely a fifth of the healthcare facilities and over a third of the primary schools. Infrastructure has been wrecked, agricultural land strewn with mines, and the economy shattered. My old organization, Oxfam, is desperate to get on with the long-term development task in the 70-plus countries in which it's involved. But already, when I completed my service in 1992, more than 50% of its work worldwide was preempted for conflict-related humanitarian crises, and in Africa, it was more than 70%. Overall, UK's official ODA expenditure on emergencies has increased fivefold since 1987, inevitably diverting funds from long-term development. Director, were an anthropological expedition to visit Earth from another galaxy, it would be impossible to give a rational explanation of human behavior on return to base. The world only spends on peacekeeping a small fraction of what it spends on arms. Indeed, it's been estimated that what is provided for all the peacekeeping activities of today only amounts to something like the combined budgets for operating the police and fire departments of New York City. But if that's not mad enough, consider the world only spends on conflict resolution and preemptive diplomacy a small proportion of what it spends on peacekeeping. We agonize over the additional resources needed by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, but we spend less than peanuts on preventing the crises that lead to the pressures on UNHCR. J. Brian Atwood, head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, put it very well last June. Just the other day, he said, we made a decision to contribute $35 million additional to handle this disaster, Rwanda. One wonders if we had $35 million in the previous 2 years, we could have done something to avoid the killing. Already, international terrorism has changed all the traditional mindset concepts of security. Nuclear, chemical, and biological capabilities generate nightmare scenarios. The weapons of mass destruction in a container ship or civilian airliner, or brought into a city in bits by hand luggage, is all too real a prospect. The black market, now operating in plutonium, rams this danger home. Indeed, major crime syndicates could soon afford such a weapon. The extent of conflict, its unpredictability, the injustice which it exacerbates, and its implications for the world as a whole are reasons enough to put global governance under scrutiny. But there are others as well. Eminent scientists in the United States National Academy of Science and the UK's Royal Society have indicated that there may be little more than 30 years in which to get a grip on international management of the environment if our children are not to find themselves confronted with a potentially terminal environmental crisis. At Rio, it was argued by Maurice Strong that the price of correcting the world's environmental problems is in the region of $625 billion per annum, and that of this, $125 billion needs to be transferred from north to south. But at the beginning of the decade, the 21 Development Assistance Committee members of OECD provided little more than $54 billion in official aid to the south. Frequently, humanitarian credentials are claimed on the basis of being in favor of sustainable development. But sustainable development raises immense issues of access and distribution. It has considerable implications for equity and social justice. It could lead to tyranny, or alternatively to anarchy, as the excluded stand up, begin to march, and demand their share. Many of the world's poorest people live in the most fragile environments. For the third world poor, especially the rural poor, the environment is not an abstract scientific concept which relates to daily life via washing powders and plastic bags. It's their very means of survival. The forests, the rivers, the land, the grasses, the marine resources, and the rainfall are what most of the world's people rely on to meet their basic needs. It matters immediately to the village farmer in Burkina Faso if the rains fail. It matters immediately to the Philippine fishing communities if their seas are overfished by huge commercial fleets. It matters immediately to the Brazilian forest people if their forest, their home, their food source, their meaning of life is desecrated. Hence the many acts of courage which can be found every day. The Indian hill women who embrace their trees in an all too often vain attempt to save them from the loggers' chainsaws. The illiterate peasants thrown off their land to make way for a dam and cheated of their compensation by corrupt civil servants, but who will not be cowed by threats. The courage of the poor, who are knocked down time and again, and always get up ready to start again, often incredibly with a smile. Yet denied access to more productive land or waters increasingly we are seeing poor people struggling to eke out a meager existence in an environment unable to support their growing numbers. Desertification, for example, is not wholly a natural phenomenon. It is the result of human interaction with the environment. Population continues to explode. The recent Cairo conference has driven home the ramifications. But this has to be seen together with consumption patterns. Effective population strategies necessarily related to functional literacy, primary health, and community work with women remain too few and far between. But at the same time, it seems, the richest 25% of the world's population are still taking something like an 80% share of the resources consumed by the world. And some have calculated that the oceans are already working at around 80% of their capacity to play their part in regenerating atmosphere. It's a mistake to imagine that the bulk of environmental problems arise in the poor world. The insatiable consumption of resources and the reckless pollution of the planet by the industrialized world relates directly to the depletion of the ozone layer and to global warming, a problem which looks set to bring devastating consequences for countries like Egypt and Bangladesh, and yet one more example of a problem where justice is conspicuously lacking. While national governments are responsible for much of this pollution, and while there are difficulties enough in working out enforceable codes of practice for governments, how much greater is the issue of the transnational corporations with their enormous wealth and power and their lack of accountability? To find an effective way of developing that accountability must be central to any concern for viable global governance. Meanwhile, the latest GATT round has once more demonstrated that the world's trading system is still largely operated in the interests of the industrialized world. Sub-Saharan Africa alone, home to 300 million people barely existing in absolute poverty, is likely to lose £1.7 billion a year, while countries of the European Union, whose citizens on average enjoy incomes 37 times as large, are expected to gain £40.8 billion per year. That is mainly due to a loss of preferential export agreements with the European Union. Meanwhile, structural adjustment programs, too often devoid of rigorous prior assessment to measure their social consequences, have frequently accentuated poverty. So, how are we to cope? With the revolution in the Soviet Union against 75 years of communism and 300 years of imperialism, do we have an unrivaled opportunity to move from a bipolar, disastrously ideological world to a multipolar, creative world in which diversity is celebrated, not least in multicultural Britain, and in which values and pragmatism apply? A new age of common sense and reason. Will we have the strength of character to see the market as a tool and never as a master, to recognize and appropriately implement its invaluable disciplines, but at the same time to appreciate that they alone will never ensure the strategic survival of humanity? Will we again come to see that the challenge to governance is to strike the healthy dynamic compromise between liberal economics and intervention for the common good, the good of our great-grandchildren no less than our own? Or are we to become prisoners of an unquestioned unipolar ideological concept with all the sinister implications that will inevitably entail? What of the ideal of service in education, health, public administration and the rest? What of original research as distinct from marketable research? What of the intensive management courses, vaguely reminiscent except for their lush surroundings, of so-called psychiatric institutions in the Soviet Union, where the principle of service is in effect rubbished and students are brainwashed into succumbing to the unadulterated market? Globally, in a multipolar world, how will a political equilibrium be established? In place of the old threats and common dangers, what will underpin this equilibrium? Could this be a determination to respond to the contaminating effect of turbulence and conflict, to find a strategic solution to migration, to forestall the danger of terminal environmental crisis? Would it be possible to generate the will to forge a strategic approach to worldwide economic and social development, bringing together trade, aid, finance, conflict resolution, education, health, environmental concerns, and more? We cannot bury our heads in the sand. We are faced with a grim resurgence of ethnic conflict across the world. And there are many hundreds, perhaps thousands of groups which could claim the right to self-determination on grounds of ethnic identity. None of the significant conflicts raging the world today is international. All are within national boundaries. What is our strategic analysis and thinking on the implications of this for a world based on the principle of the sacrosanct sovereignty of the nation state? Do we really envisage a world of potentially 3,000 nation states? The biggest single challenge to the evolution of governments is how we find international means to ensure human rights and cultural self-respect before the ethnic entrepreneurs, as I've recently heard them described by my good friend Kumar Rupsinger of International Alert, whom I'm glad to see here today, before the ethnic entrepreneurs and the wild men take over. The huge organization and expenditure mobilized to deal with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, claimed as Iraqi territory, stands in stark contrast to the small scale or total absence of action over Rwanda, Burundi, Sudan, the Marsh Arabs, Nagorno-Karabakh, or East Timor. How long can the claims of sovereignty be allowed to permit governments to abuse their citizens with impunity? If we accept the inescapability of international interdependence, it's essential to examine the international dimensions of governance. This quickly brings us to the hypocrisy, contradictions, and confusions which currently confront us, and to some of which I've already referred this evening. In a paper for the school's Center for the Study of Global Governments, I drew attention to the multiplicity of international institutions with different levels of engagement and commitment into which players dip at their convenience. Divide and fail applies, I suggested, in effect, if not, which I sometimes doubt, in intent. IMF, World Bank, UNCTAD, GATT, G7, NATO, CSCE, and the UN system, not least UNCED. The new rhetoric is about regeneration of the UN system. But where is the evidence of concerted commitment? What level of seniority does the UN department have within the Foreign and Commonwealth Office? How can the UN be more than a glorified Red Cross while the key international financial institutions remain largely separate players? What are the long-term prospects for UN-coordinated collective security if the UN is merely to be used as a subcontractor or fig leaf for the priorities of the powerful, with little evidence of any convincing criteria for consistency? Do we settle for Pax Americana, or do we want an effective, genuinely global system? How should we move towards resolving these problems? I'm convinced we need a strengthened Security Council with responsibility for strategic direction. To have credibility, it must have revised membership. Germany and Japan are obvious candidates for permanent places. But that will mean three permanent places, two for historic rather than for currently valid reasons, for Europe, France, the UK, and Germany. Over time, the case for one European Union seat may well become powerful. And this could usher in an era of regional representation, although no other regional arrangement is yet remotely ready for the starting line. Third world representation has to be strengthened also, and the veto system should be allowed to wither on the vine. The Secretary General badly needs something akin to the European Union Commission in its better days, working committedly with him to keep the dynamism and strategic direction alive. At the moment, his lonely isolation on the 38th floor is like a scene from Dr. Strangelove. The international financial institutions should work to the Security Council through the Secretary General and his team, as would the other UN agencies, hopefully rationalized and reduced in number. UNIDO, UNCTAD, and IGSOC might go for a start, and cooperating on well-defined tasks. The UN system has to be dragged out of its introspective institutional politicking. It simply has to become task-orientated. There would, as originally envisaged, have to be a highly professional Chiefs of Staff committee responsible for collective security operations, preferably with its own directly recruited rapid deployment force, available to forestall escalation, and supported by high-quality international intelligence inputs and an effective communications centre. This committee would work through the Secretary-General to the Security Council. Criteria will have to be established whereby the UN, on the authority of the Security Council, could challenge sovereignty on humanitarian as well as on political and strategic grounds. It is certainly no longer tolerable that tyrants with no electoral or popular legitimacy can invoke sovereignty to block humanitarian intervention, especially so when it is clear that in the end, intervention is likely to happen, but too late and at maximum cost. This need to act in time to prevent escalation cannot be overemphasized. It's salutary to remember that as much as a quarter of the British Army has been tied up in Northern Ireland alone. Clearly, on occasion, it's likely that a rapid deployment force of itself will not suffice. Ad hoc, multilateral forces will then become necessary, perhaps on a regional basis. But these must always be deployed on the real collective authority of the UN, and never with post hoc UN approval given only under duress. What matters most is demonstrable consistency and, for example, the avoidance of arbitrariness dictated by media hype. Early warning, strengthened conflict resolution capabilities, effective policing of the arms trade, backed by a long overdue code of practice and generous resources for hard-headed arms substitution and conversion programs, and above all, preemptive diplomacy rather than reactive diplomacy, are all indispensable elements for a credible UN. To provide a firm context for all this, the role of the International Court of Justice must be enhanced. An International War Crimes Tribunal could indeed also have a vital role to play, but to be credible, its mandate must be global, and again, it must be consistent. Selectivity would be wrong in principle and counterproductive in practice. As happens in the European Union, it would make sense to have different combinations of people working on different sectors of global policy in the Security Council, but all accountable to the Security Council in its most senior form. Foreign ministers would frequently attend, as would other ministers, to deal with their appropriate sectors. At other times, the latest communications and information technology could be applied in a disciplined way to facilitate decision-making. High on the agenda of the Security Council would be the world economy, environmental policy and migration, as well as conflict and its resolution, peacekeeping and humanitarian emergencies. But Director, the Security Council is not, of course, the whole UN. It is there to act for the UN, but its accountability to the General Assembly must be sharpened. This will involve strengthening the General Assembly itself to make it more effectively representative of we the peoples of the United Nations. And I just hope that LSE is already hard at work on leading the thought on how this might best be achieved. To those who ask, but why is all this the remit of the Security Council? The answer is surely that lasting peace and security depend upon the fulfillment of human, economic and social rights, as was so clearly seen in 1948, and upon the accountability of power, and that, for example, the growing environmental threat is every bit as much a threat to the future of mankind as those highlighted by the founders of the UN in 1945. But all this will not happen at once. Obviously it won't. But in the short term, the authority of the Secretary General has to be increased, both in terms of the seriousness given to the appointment itself and in terms of the resources at his or her disposal. I well remember the senior French diplomat who, when asked by a small group of humanitarian agency heads, including me, what were the most important criteria agreed by governments for the appointment of a new Secretary General, looked at us flabbergasted and replied with total candor, "You know perfectly well, the most important criterion is that we must on no account have a strong Secretary General. Political leaders are adept at talking of the UN as something separate from themselves. It is not. It is their UN. In democracies like the UK, it is our UN, and we must never forget it. When we spotlight its many failures, it is as well to examine our own role and commitment first. The UK was, after all, a permanent member of the Security Council, which voted to reduce the level of UN presence in Rwanda just at the time when many on the spot and many within the UN system, not least the Secretary General himself, argued that an increased presence would help to limit, if not prevent, the horrors ahead. And let me here share a nightmare. I fear that having dismally failed, or worse, on Rwanda, we may be about to repeat the crime again on Burundi. Virtually all the indications are that it's not a matter of whether genocide is possible there, but when it will happen. Already there is slaughter. Yet what is the world doing? Where are the monitors for whom the UN Commissioner for Human Rights has called? Shall we really be able to look ourselves in the face next year if we allow it all to happen again? Burundi is about containing the unacceptable. In a sane world community, the attention of experts, academics, politicians, and practitioners would now be focused on Kenya, Nigeria, Cameroon, and Zaire in Africa alone, if preemptive diplomacy and conflict resolution had the priority they logically merit in human affairs. Not deliberately or inadvertently to disempower the key players of the countries themselves, of course not, but to support them in finding viable humanitarian solutions. At a time when the virtues of good governance and democracy, in other words, accountable government, are preached to the South, it is to me incredible that those same disciplines are so openly thwarted globally. The international financial institutions must be brought into line in a cohesive strategy. They should play a critical role in deciding what policies are economically possible, but beyond that, they are there to service economic and social priorities, not to dictate them. Another urgent test of serious intent is to resolve the financial mess which surrounds the UN. It's difficult to overestimate the damage done by the cynical process of repeatedly overloading the organization with no attempt to guarantee the necessary resources. Either a task is a UN task or is it not, or it is not. If it is, the concept of so-called voluntary contributions is a contradiction. Of course, the corollary is that there must be a tough, cost-effective professionalism in the management of the UN system. At present, the almost total absence of such a culture is disastrous. To put this right, we'll call for the highest caliber of talented leadership at all levels. But it will also call for the governments of member states to stop playing ducks and drakes, rewards, banishments, hidden perks to sustain allegiance and the rest with personnel. We need a genuinely international civil servants with preferment based on merit and free from manipulation by member states. But Director, governance is by definition about much more than the behavior of governments alone, individually and collectively. It encompasses the whole complex of human activity. Let me therefore continue for a moment to draw on my paper for your center of study, for the study of global governance, and say a few words about grassroots organization with particular reference to the environment, and also about corporatism and the media. Let me start with the grassroots example. I subscribe to the principle of primary environmental care, which holds that the most effective approach to sustainable development starts at the local community level. First, empowerment. Empowerment seeks to involve the full and active participation of all parts of a community. It means the recognition of people's rights to control the land and other resources on which they depend in urban as well as rural areas. And I'm delighted to see Anne Power here. Second, securing basic needs. Securing basic needs is the process by which the rights of people to have a say in the distribution of resources to improve their incomes food security, shelter, and access to better health care and education, sanitation, and water supplies is ensured. It is also about their human rights. Third, caring for the environment. Caring for the environment involves people in rehabilitating degraded environments, protecting natural resources, for example, through soil and water conservation measures, and generating new resources by planting trees or digging wells. Experience suggests that success depends upon the interplay of all three elements. Primary environmental care is a response to locally expressed needs for environmental and social change, preventative as well as curative, which goes well beyond mere technical solutions alone. Many wider environmental problems are aggregations of local problems. If replicated widely enough, primary environmental care at local level will contribute significantly to the solution of global problems such as deforestation and the loss of biodiversity. I insert this example not to argue that global environmental success is possible without political determination to tackle the many national and international obstacles to sustainable development and to regulate industry and commerce effectively. I do so only to emphasize that future management of the world requires a balance between national and international strategy and local action. Now, briefly, a word on corporatism. The private, public, and voluntary sectors are all central to the dynamic of society. In the UK, beyond special pleading, too often they are extraordinarily, even dangerously passive about their role in the formation of strategic social policy. Of course, their primary objective must be the efficient and cost-effective fulfillment of their primary purpose, profitability, a good public service, meeting the objective for which the organisation exists. But is that enough? My heart sinks whenever I hear leading figures in the private, public, or voluntary sectors say, when challenged, but that's not our role. If the world is conceivably heading towards a terminal condition, can highly intelligent, talented executives really suppress their anxieties about the global inheritance they will provide for their children and grandchildren? Can they really continue to play a short-term tactical game at God knows what long-term expense? That's madness. A bad situation is made worse when, with all the denigration of public service and politics and the ideological blitz to which they've been subjected, it's possible that people of the highest caliber may no longer be attracted to politics and the public or civil service. It is, in effect, unacceptably cynical for those, even, dare I mention it, on occasion vice-chancellors, who say, but we shall, of course, comply with what is required of us by government, if they are doing too little to contribute constructively to the strategic political debate and to focus on what they believe is the action required. Democracy is not just about the integrity of elections. Its quality depends upon the quality and vibrance of civil society. No review of governments would be complete without a word on the media. No democracy can be better than the quality of the information on which it is functioning. Taken together, the short-termism of the media and the degree to which it has increasingly become merely a commodity to be sold constitute a major challenge. With thinking journalists not yet altogether an extinct species, the need is to reinforce their own anxieties about what is basically wrong, to the point at which they shake off their inhibitions of the wine bar mores and write or make programs about what they know to be important. And glad to see Colin Legium here, if need be, to stand up firmly to sub-editors and owners, confident of an articulate and committed body of public support. They can play a crucial part in building up an understanding of the issues that have to be addressed, even a demand that they are addressed, rather than ramming ill-prepared solutions down unprepared throats, a repeated fault of the conventional political world. As in the case of the general public, it's necessary to relate to many journalists where they are if contact is to be made as a basis for moving the argument forward. Terrorism, drugs, migration, genocide may have to be the starting points, as indeed they have to be for not unconnected reasons with not a few conventional politicians. Director, I find it very exciting that 1995 should see both the 50th anniversary of the UN and the centenary of LSE. What strikes me in the origins of both It's the commitment, the determination of the founders. They believed things could be better and committed themselves to make it so. No academic voyeurism for them. The Fabian Henry Hutchinson, who died in 1894, leaving the money with which the school was started, instructed Sidney Webb and four other trustees that they were to dispose of the residue of his estate for socially progressive purposes. Our calendar reminds us of that. We set it out in the calendar. Sidney Webb saw the role of the school as to contribute to the improvement of society by promoting the impartial study of its problems and the training of those who were to translate policy into action. The amassing of facts and their careful analysis were not then seen primarily as self-gratifying or the road to self-glorification. The process was for a wider benefit. Later, the instinctively caring Lusky, loved by those who disagreed, often at least as much as by those who agreed with him, used to emphasize the significance of the inarticulate major premise. Even if we cannot define it, we must continually probe and examine both ourselves and others who present their findings to us. Recently, we've grieved at the passing of that giant popper. As my sister, who was here and is here today, ahead of me, and I always envied her being here in that post-war era, as she reminded me, he, in the basement lecture room adjacent to the men's lavatories, as she put it, perhaps an indication of his tentative place in LSE's scheme of things, Popper used to argue that we can prove nothing from amassing facts except facts we have amassed. Formulation of hypotheses is an intuitive leap in the dark from a database to a new foothold, which must be sustained by argument followed by testing and modification, first on the part of the researcher and subsequently by the research community. Such leaps require intellectual courage and fresh motivation, coupled with the courage of humility to submit new hypotheses to testing and to be prepared to make or accept modification. Not to admit, or more dangerous, not to recognize our motivation or our bias in the formulation of hypotheses does not mean we have none or that we make no a priori assumptions. I say this because of the fear that while we may not yet entirely have surrendered the claim that truth or the search for truth have social value, we may be becoming increasingly selective about the truths we are seeking. We advance the possibility that the nourishing of individual talent and individual potential can contribute to social good. But do we use this as an argument in favor of selective education towards selected ends? Because wealth can be most easily assessed in monetary terms, have we convinced ourselves that only the possession of money is wealth, that the communal assets of a society, such as health of children, vigor of the working population, care of the elderly, quality of education and the arts, applied compassion both in our national and international affairs, are not wealth? Have we really succumbed to the belief that to follow the star of excellence must be synonymous with the pursuit of worldly material achievement and that one should necessarily be measured in terms of the other? In seeking to justify the pursuit of money on its own as the only honest goal because of its obvious social necessity, have we not lulled ourselves into believing that because the machinery of humanity is not possible without economic growth, the effects of economic growth will inevitably be humane? Manifestly, inevitably, they are not. But of course, they can be. Informed intervention can be effective. The onus is on those who can, not only to intervene, but first to be constantly on the alert to know when intervention is necessary and where and when it can be best applied, and of course, to be informed. It used, Director, to be a matter of considerable pride that this school had been a working people's college. Firmly embedded in that record is a belief in the potential dignity of all human beings. Amongst the school's more lively students, the indignity imposed on too many human beings has always been a subject of wrath. Today, the harrowing problems of sometimes subtle, sometimes unsubtle deprivation of liberty, of human degradation, of so-called third world poverty, never truly a geographically limited reality, have crept back into the alleys and under the bridges of this very London which surrounds us. Do those of us who in a host of ways, not least by parenthood, seek to guide the young, still feel any personal sense of wrath? Or do we drown in our own sense of impotence? If the Thatcher years taught us nothing else, they surely demonstrated the significance of will. What we desperately need, and what the school is in very special position to provide, is the will for reason, not ideological prejudice, to prevail, and the will to apply what reason demonstrates as essential. As we prepare for the school's centenary, let us all, above all, celebrate the imagination of our founders, a regeneration of vision and commitment, and an unyielding concern for values coupled with a relentless practicality in focusing on how the quality of life can be improved is the way I believe we can remain true to those who inspired the early years. Nothing could be more relevant as we come up to the 50th anniversary of the UN itself. The challenges of the century ahead and the urgency to find effective systems of governance whereby to respond are exactly the challenges to which Hutchinson and Webb would have risen. I look forward to the school doing just that. Perhaps I could conclude with a quotation from Markings, a collection of poetry and prose by that fine international public servant, Dag Hammarskjöld, and one last anecdote from my Oxfam days. First, Dag Hammarskjöld. Never look down to test the ground before taking your next step. Only he who keeps his eye fixed on the far horizon will find his right road. Life yields only to the conqueror. Never accept what can be gained by giving in. You will be living off stolen goods, and your muscles will atrophy. In my first days at Oxfam, I visited Haiti, about which we've heard so much of late. I was immensely impressed by the courage of the poor under the most appalling regime. Duvalier was still there. Deep, going back one night to my residence, I passed his seaside place, surrounded by the Tonton Macoute and all the rest, and I wrote in my diary, who is the prisoner in this society? On the last day I was there, I was talking with a wonderful American sister who'd been there 20 years working with the destitute and the unemployed. And she was full of anger about the repression and the exploitation, but she even then was full of hope about the future. And while I was talking to her, I saw on the wall behind her, and it haunts me, that picture, a picture of a healthy, fit, young woman holding a beaming, laughing baby in her arms. And across the poster in Haitian French were the words, "Quand le bonheur des uns est au prix du malheur des autres, moi, dit Dieu, je veux que cela change." When the well-being of some is at the price of the suffering of others, I say, God, I wish that that should change. It's by our response to that challenge that I believe history will judge us. Recent developments in the Middle East, in South Africa, and now in Ireland give us solid grounds for hope.
Well, on behalf of you all, it falls to me to thank you, Frank, for what was, by any standards, an address in the best traditions, I think, of this theatre, which has, in its time, seen many powerful rhetorical pleas. And I think, too, you set us off on our centennial year on the best of all possible paths. I'm sure our founders, all of them, not just Sydney and Beatrice, I'm sure our founders would have echoed every word of that. Indeed, we know in the case of Sydney and Beatrice from their diaries that in fact they had very similar thoughts. It's that combination of vision on the one hand, outrage on the other, and a wish to devise practical ways of solving the perceived problems that, after all, drove them to found this school, and which have, in many various guises and many different ways in different times, driven it since then. And I would, of course, say, you as a governor know, drive it still. So thank you very much for a superb address, which will make us all go into this centennial year very thoughtful. But now it's my very great pleasure to invite you all to negotiate our lifts, which sometimes bear a passing resemblance to the Third World, to the senior common room, where we will have a reception. Thank you very much, friend.